The Bible reading today is from Philippians chapter 4, verses 10 to 20. Paul is thanking the Philippian believers for their gift to him. I rejoiced greatly in the Lord that at last you renewed your concern for me. Indeed, you were concerned, but you had no opportunity to show it. I'm not saying this because I am in need, for I have learned to be content whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do all this through him who gives me strength. Yet it was good of you to share in my troubles. Moreover, as you Philippians know, in the early days of your acquaintance with the gospel, when I set out from Macedonia, not one church shared with me in the matter of giving and receiving, except you only. For even when I was in Thessalonica, you sent me aid more than once when I was in need. Not that I desire your gifts. What I desire is that more be accredited to your account. I have received full payment and have more than enough. I am amply supplied now that I have received from Epaphroditus the gifts you sent. They are a fragrant offering, an acceptable sacrifice, pleasing to God. And my God will meet all your needs according to the riches of his glory in Christ Jesus. To our God and Father be glory forever and ever. Amen.
Thank you, Marion. And so as we've heard, we are going to be talking about giving, and people in this church give in different ways. We passed the offering bag a little while ago. People give financially. People give by volunteering, that very valuable gift of volunteering at a working bee or putting together an event. But why do we do this? And that's really the big question today. I was reminded that when Persa and I were living down in the Balmain-Roselle area, one of the first churches that I worked for in the Sydney area. And if you don't know the history, I mean, Balmain used to be a poor fishing village with little poor fishing cottages, and then it became incredibly gentrified. And we were there during one of the great financial growth spurts of Sydney. We lived there during the decade where housing prices in Sydney tripled in one decade. And if you were on the right side of that property wave, you were laughing. We weren't on the right side of the property wave, and it made it really difficult for others. But we were attending a church at that stage that was relatively well off. It had a lot of high-paid workers who were on the right end of the property wave, and a lot of wealth had been created. But one of the things that I was struggling with was getting volunteers, because it was a regionally based church. And I was speaking to one of the leaders about this, and I really love this guy, because a good guy, he's just one of those guys that didn't have a filter and just said what he was thinking. And he said, the thing is, Chad, you've got to realize that the reason we give to the offering is because all of us in this church are financially rich, but we are time poor. So we put money in the offering plate so that we can hire staff like you guys so that you can do the work of the church. And I thought it was a really wonderful, crystal clear, and yet one of the most poor explanations of why we give that I have ever heard. And we were able to go on and have some more conversations about it. But as a vision for giving, it was incredibly short-sighted. And so one of a better explanation of that video, it's like 5 minutes of gold of why people in the church give. And you may not have picked up the natural progression of how we get from giving just strictly to the poor to giving in general, but Jesus had no problem making that leap. Back in the prophet Isaiah, more than six centuries before Christ was born on this earth, Isaiah wrote a prophetic vision. And he said, when the Messiah comes, he will come to proclaim good news to the poor. And then he went on to say, he'll heal the sick and he'll release the prisoner who has been unjustly imprisoned. And then when Jesus turns up more than six centuries later, he stands up in the synagogue, in the church. He reads from that very passage about the Messiah coming to proclaim good news to the poor. And he says, guess what? I am here. I have come to proclaim good news to the poor and heal the sick and release the captives. But as you followed Jesus' ministry, you became very aware very quickly that when he was talking about the poor and the needy and those needing cleansing and released from prison, he wasn't just talking to the poor. He was talking to the priest as much as he was talking to the poor. He was talking to the rich as much as he was talking to the poor. Because from Jesus' standpoint, we're all spiritually impoverished. We're all poor and needy. We're all in need of cleansing. We are all held captive to sin and need to be released. We are all poor before God, and we all need the riches of God in Jesus Christ to come and feed us our living bread, to give us our living water, to clothe us from our spiritual nakedness, and to provide healing that sin has brought upon all of us. And so this was a teaching not just about the poor, but about everyone. And that's why on the screen in front of you, when Paul wrote his great gospel treatise to the Romans, reading from chapter 10, verse 13, he said, everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. But then he goes on to say this, how then can they call on the one that they have not believed in? And how can they believe in the one whom they have not heard? And how can they hear without someone preaching to them? And how can anyone preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. And so from Paul's perspective, the feet of those who bring good news are not just the preacher who stands there in the town square and proclaims the gospel. It is the feet of those who have sent them, who has made that trip possible, who are standing behind the scenes praying for the success of that trip, for basically for the whole church. We all have beautiful feet when we're involved in gospel ministry. And if there's one thing I hope you've picked up during this series about promoting the gospel, following Jesus' example, the gospel is always best presented and promoted when we meet people at their point of physical need, as Jesus did. He fed the 5,000 and he healed the sick and he, you know, brought in those who had been cast out because of leprosy or because of social exclusion. But he always did that to make people aware of their spiritual needs, of their spiritual blindness, of their dead hearts, of their need for him. And so the gospel is always promoted best when we meet people's physical needs, as Rob put it, as a pathway to helping them to understand their spiritual needs. And that brings us to the letter that Paul writes to the Philippians. And I just want to give us a little bit of context, because as Marian rightly pointed out, sometimes Bible scholars talk about the occasion for the letter. Why did Paul write this? And there's a lot of wonderful theology in the book of Philippians, but the occasion seems to be that it was a thank you letter. When you read the letter to the Galatians, it's a rebuke for their heresy. When you read his letter to the Corinthians, he has all of these problems in the church that he needs to correct. But whether you were a first-time reader of Philippians or whether you're a Bible scholar, the thing that you can't miss and the thing that you can't pass up is the fact that it is a book overflowing with thanks and with joy. And the reason for that is that Paul is in prison, most likely in Rome. He doesn't know whether he'll be released or whether he will be executed and die there. But there in his hour of need, the Philippian church has continued a long-standing partnership with him. They've sent one of their members with what was probably a care package, okay? There's no wire transfers back in the day. They didn't have a check in an envelope. And the coins for Paul would have been of limited value. But as we know in other letters, when he asks someone, please bring my cloak that I left back and wherever, or please bring me my parchments that I have left behind, because you just had to travel with what you could put on your back. And they had obviously put together this very thoughtful care package for Paul, and he was thanking them for that in chapter 1, verse 3. I thank my God every time I remember you in all my prayers for you. I always pray with joy because of your partnership in the gospel. From the first day when Paul went into Philippi and preached the gospel and a number of them were saved, from that first day until now. Here was a church that had freely received from Paul and from his ministry, and now they would freely give to him so that that ministry could continue to others. And so within that, that's chapter one of the letter, and now we get to the other end in chapter four, the final chapter. We pick up these three really basic principles. This is why we give. This is why we volunteer. And the first of those is that giving is an opportunity to spiritually partner in the gospel. Not all of us are preachers. Most of us aren't. Not always, all of us feel comfortable standing up in front of groups. Most people don't. But this is a way for us to partner in the gospel. Paul writes in chapter 4, verse 10, I rejoice greatly in the Lord that at last you renewed your concern for me. Indeed, you were concerned, but you had no opportunity to show it. And then a little bit later on, verse 14, Paul goes on to say, yet it was good of you to share in my troubles. By that he means his imprisonment. Moreover, as you Philippians know, in the early days of your acquaintance with the gospel, when I set out from Macedonia, not one church shared with me in the matter of giving and receiving, except you only. For even when I was in Thessalonica, you sent me aid more than once when I was in need. I just want us to contemplate this, and we don't know for sure, but we know that this servant had brought along this care package, and based on other letters, we know the kind of things that might have been in that, you know, a warm cloak that which you're going to need in prison. But in the past, he had asked about, you know, he needed his parchments. Paul was in prison. This may have been his last gig. What was his ministry in prison? Writing the scriptures that we have today. Wouldn't it be an amazing thing if it included in that care package were his parchments, was his pen and ink and stationery set, which then he used to write this letter? And could you imagine the people of that church saying, I know it's not much, but we've included some paper and some pen and some ink so that you can continue your letter writing ministry. What an investment. What an investment. That letter, this letter that we have read here that has gone out throughout the whole world and been translated into hundreds of different languages all around and has brought strength and faith and encouragement. And one day we might get a chance to go and meet the people who went and sent that care package, and all of us can gather around. As I believe heaven, part of heaven is us just having the opportunity to meet other people and to realize the connection that they had in our lives and to think, the Bible that you purchased, the speaker that you paid, the gift that was given that opened my eyes to the gospel, that thing that you said, it's probably not worth very much, and you might have used it to go and get a coffee and a muffin or whatever else, that investment changed my life. And it didn't just change my life, then it changed my family's life, and it changed my friend's life, and it changed the community. What an investment it is to take a seed and to plant it in the ground and to partner in the gospel. And there is some obligation in this. One of the principles that Paul brings out in one of his other letters comes from the Old Testament. It says this, don't muzzle the oxen when it's treading out the grain. I love this verse because if you think about it, if you break it down, it's incredibly powerful. First of all, it's not written to oxen, right? Because ox don't tend to read very well. And it's actually talking to the people who might be tempted to put a muzzle over the ox's mouth because we don't need the ox eating all of the grain. And we need the ox to be doing the work. But what is this ox actually doing? It's pulling the plow, which tills the ground, which makes it possible to plant the seed for the grain. Then it pulls the cart, which is, you know, being brought along, and hauls all the grain that needs to go in. Then it's put on the grinding wheel, and it becomes the engine room, and it grinds the grain into flour for you to have your daily bread. The ox is working so that you can have your daily bread. So how wrong would it be to say, oh, we don't want you eating our daily bread, Mr. Ox. That's for us. A worker is worthy of a wage. And God gives us this beautiful picture of the ox, you know, laboring as a way of saying, if we're going to send out gospel workers, it's our job to support them. If they're going to be distributing to others the same daily bread that we have received and the same bread of life that we have received, which has given us eternal life, then let's make sure that we feed those who are taking out the gospel and the good news to them. But that's not where Paul finishes, and I don't think it's the driving force of his reasons for giving, because Paul then goes on to say in verse 17, not that I desire your gifts. What I desire is that more would be credited to your account. I know that sometimes if you watch some tele-evangelism ministries, you get these charlatans who come on and they bless a piece of cloth and they say, if you send me some money, you can go and stick this under your pillow and then magically, you know, $100 will appear underneath it and God will multiply your gifts. And that is not at all the sort of multiplying that Paul is talking about. In fact, there's a principle that runs through his letters. He says that we reap what we sow. Now, when we hear that today, we think it's like a karma thing. If you do the wrong thing, it's going to come back to you. And it can have that idea. You sow bad seed, you're going to reap bad fruit. But there's a positive side to it as well. So here's the idea. Imagine you're sitting there going, it's planting time, but you know what? I don't have a great deal of money. So if I go out and buy a whole bunch of seed, that's going to cost me more money. Plus, more seed is going to require more ground, and that's going to cost me more money. And then more ground is going to require a bigger team of oxen. It's going to require more servants later on to go out and do the reaping. The whole thing is going to cost me a whole lot of money. So you just get a whole small handful of seed and decide to do it modestly. Now it comes harvest time. And you're going, why in the world do all these other people have this giant harvest and I have this little tiny harvest? Well, because you reap what you sow. If you invest a little bit, then you'll get a modest return. He who sows sparingly will reap sparingly. If you sow generously, then you will receive a generous return, 30, 60, 100 times more than what was sown, especially if you are investing in God's kingdom, and he is the one blessing that investment. So he's saying, I'm not sitting here crying poor. I mean, it's wonderful that you sent me the care package, but what I'm more interested in seeing what your investment will do. When we're having those heavenly conversations, won't it be wonderful the day that you realize all of the blessings that came out of your sharing? We give believing that God can invest and bless that investment. I remember back when our kids were little, and they did some work for us at home, and they have weekend jobs. They'd go and wash cars for people or whatever. And Bruce and I would be talking at tax time about our tax return and what we thought we would get back at our tax return. And they'd say, do we get a tax return? And I'd say, did you pay any taxes? Well, no. I said, well, you can't get a return on what you didn't put in. You can't get a return on an investment that you never invested in. And so Paul said, one good reason investing in God's kingdom is to get the return on that investment. The second reason he gives for that we should give is because Our giving demonstrates our thanks, and it also demonstrates our contentment. I'm going to read to you from verse 11. Paul says, "It wasn't that I had necessarily these great needs. I've learned to be content in whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need. I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or want." Wouldn't you love to know the secret of being able to be thankful and content in every situation? "I can do all things through him who gives me strength." I know that God will always look after me. I may not have everything that I want all the time, but I'm always going to have what I need. Tomorrow and today, I will always have whatever I need. And Jesus said this, "Don't worry, I'm feeding the sparrows out there. I'm looking after the trees, I'm looking after the flowers. All of these things that mean nothing, I make sure that they have what they need. I'll always make sure that you have what you need. You won't always have what you want. Yes, you'll know some hunger. Yes, you'll know some lean times. Yes, you'll have some times you're under financial stress, but I'll make sure that you have what you need. Don't worry. God will supply all your needs." And over in his letter to Timothy, I love this. He has this wonderful phrase where he says, "Godliness with contentment equals the greatest gain." We all want the best gains, right? We all want returns. You know, when we're out there shopping around for superannuation or investment plans, and we always say, which is going to give us the greatest gain? Where do I get the best return on my money? He said, "I can tell you, if you have godly, thankful contentment, you will always have everything that you want and everything that you need." You know why? Because you're content. And therefore, you will always have everything that you want and everything that you need. I was having a chat with one of our hands and feet volunteers, lovely lady who is here every single week. She comes in and she helps set up. She's always one of the last people to leave. She has kids, single income family. She's got lots and lots of needs, and that's one of the reasons why she comes here, not only receives her basket of food, but she volunteers hours of her time every single week. And so from time to time, I'll walk up to her and I'll say, "How are you doing? Tell me about yourself." And she said, "Every day I just try to remember to get up and to be thankful to God. And when my kids come to me and complain and whinge about all the things that their friends have that they don't have, I always just say, just look around at what you have and thank God for what you have." And I was preparing this talk and I quoted this verse back to her and she said, "That's right. That's right. If we're content, then we all always have what we need. What else do you need? I have everything I need." And you know, you compare that to the mega rich rock stars and the Hollywood elite, and you see these people who have millions and millions of dollars, and yet they go bankrupt, or they find themselves in addiction, trying to kill their pain with drugs and alcohol, and you see them wandering around and looking like vagrants on the street, miserable. And that's because if you were a millionaire or you're a billionaire, if you're the poor guy who is only number 500 on the rich of the 500 billionaires in the world, and you go, "Oh man, I made the list, but I'm only 500. You never have enough. And this is what we learn from the rich. You never have enough. $1 billion is a ridiculous amount of money. You can't spend the interest on it. It's ridiculous. But the billionaires, if you talk to them, they will never have enough. Or you can have a hands and feet lady who comes and volunteers and says, "I have everything that I need." If you learn godly contentment, you always have everything that you need and you want for nothing. And the last principle is this one, that giving is an act of worship. Paul writes in verse 18, "I have received full payment. I have more than enough now. I'm amply supplied now that I've received from Epaphroditus the gifts you sent. They are a fragrant offering, an acceptable sacrifice pleasing to God. And my God will meet all your needs according to his glorious riches in Christ Jesus. To God, to our God and Father, be glory forever and ever. One of the great symbols of the Old Testament temple is the idea of the incense that they would burn. And everything in the temple had a purpose for it. The incense was there to remind us that in the morning when we come in here on a Sunday morning, we sing a song. We have to remember not to say we're going to sing our next song. Our praise rises up to heaven like incense. And God said, oh, I love that. And when we offer our gifts and our services in very various ways, it rises up to God. And he said, oh, I love that. Love seeing that video at the end with all of those names. I love seeing all the people who were here yesterday helping out in various ways. Love seeing all the ways that people are helping out and serving at church each day. Love seeing them coming together and singing songs together. And I love it when they're willing to give back a portion of what I've given to them because they love me and they trust me. It rises up. I mean, which parent in here doesn't like to hear their children say thank you? Or to acknowledge the good things that you've done. And those moments when they come back and they say, Mom, Dad, you've blessed me and you've helped us in so many ways. What parent is not blessed by that? And just a little challenge, whether you're someone like myself who gives by direct transfer on a monthly basis, or whether you're someone who puts money into, you know, an envelope and puts it in the offering, just always remember, before you do it, to say, thank you, God. What I'm giving back is just a portion of what you've given to me. And now may it be a blessing to someone else as well. I wanted to throw this little slide in at the very end. And I wanted to throw it in because I think sometimes when we're teaching on money, you know, money is one of those things like politics, we're not meant to talk about it. But the Bible has no problem talking about money and about giving and what it's all about. But from time to time, and we've hit this time recently, there will be a financial scandal, and it usually involves some mega church that's nearby, and everyone suddenly will be talking about that, and then it's the church is on the nose, and all these churches that are so rich, and you know, they're taking all of our money, and they don't pay their taxes, and all of this kind of stuff, and they're, you know, they're the ones sucking the money out of, you know, the good of Australian society. So there's an article that I've referenced, and it's written by Natasha Moore, and I know Natasha, and Parissa and I, we've had her come and speak at a previous church. She's a very well-educated and very well-learned person. She also writes on all issues very fairly. If the church needs to be called out for something, she will call them out. But she wrote this article for the Sydney Morning Herald back in 2016 when a similar scandal was breaking. Just to clear up some misnomers. So the link's there and you can read it for yourself, but I just want to very quickly quote a few of these things because while we're talking about money in the church, it's a good moment for a little bit of education. So first of all, most Australian churches aren't big. We're not a nation of mega churches. Do you know that, and I've rounded off these numbers a little bit to help us get them into our minds, but 50% of the churches in Australia have 50 people or fewer. 50% of the churches in Australia have 50 people or fewer. 5% of the churches in Australia have more than 500. 5% have more than 500. And 500 is not really that big of a church. In other words, we are not a church, we're not a nation of mega churches. We have very, very few. And most churches are, you know, basically being financed from the widow's mite and not from millions of rich and wealthy people. Secondly, churches are not like other organizations. You heard John Dixon talking about this back in the early days of the empire when churches were first given tax exemptions, because we're not the only ones. There are all kinds of organizations and clubs and charities and societies that are given tax breaks. Why? Because they're not for-profit businesses. And so if you're a for-profit business, then you have to pay taxes on your profit. If you're a not-for-profit business, then you can have tax breaks. And churches receive some tax breaks, not all. I pay my taxes and I give to my offering, and churches do pay taxes. they get some tax breaks, and part of the reason for that is, first of all, because we are not for profit, but secondly, every dollar that you give is already taxed, right? You probably picked this up. If you give to World Vision, you get to claim that back as a tax deduction. You give to your church, you pay taxes on it. It's already been taxed. You were already paying the taxes. And therefore, because churches operate from the donations of the people and they are there for the good of society, we're given not tax-free exemption, but we are given some tax breaks. 23 out of 25 of the largest charities in Australia are faith-based. In fact, are Christian-based. In other words, the government recognizes that along with our public education system, our public hospital system, and the entire network of charities that are there to care for the poor, it was all handed over to the state by the church. And to this very day, the church continues to provide millions of volunteers that help out with charities like Hands and Feet and others. And it's estimated that the church contributes billions of dollars back to the government for the good of society. And everyone, they've done the numbers and they've run the sums. If the church shut down today, Australia, like many other nations in the world, would become much poorer. And not necessarily looked at in the GDP and amongst the rich, but in the way that it would affect the poor. And that is why we are given some tax breaks. In other words, if you put it back in Jesus' words, he said that he put us here to be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. In other words, the church is here to take the light of Christ, and we are here to add value to the society around it. Not to take from it, but to add value back to it. Now I want to conclude with just these words of Jesus. It's interesting, these words of Jesus are only included in Acts, and they are included by Paul when he's given a speech to the Ephesians. And basically, he quotes Jesus saying that it is more blessed to give than it is to receive. I'm married to a woman whose love language is gift giving. So when it comes time to birthday time or anniversary time, Parissa's greatest joy is to go in and find the perfect gift, but then to wrap it in the perfect way, and then to get the perfect card and to write the perfect thing inside of it, because when someone opens it up, she doesn't want them just to say, oh, that's nice, but to go, wow, how did you know? You know, I can't believe you paid that much attention. And the joy that is on her face is much bigger than the joy that is on the person who's received the gift, because she understands something about God's nature. When we were born into this world, when we were created in this world, we came in with nothing. We were naked. When we leave this world, we will leave with nothing, and everything that we will have in between came from God. It's his great joy to give good gifts to his children. And when we participate in the blessing of giving, we participate in the very nature of our good and loving God. We're going to sing a song now that celebrates that very thing, and then we're going to come and share in communion together.